This is the current federal tax developments for the week of February the 19th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be talking to you this week about some of the odd and various things that happened to us in taxes. Some of you may be aware, you may be thinking we're going to talk about the 300 regulations that Treasury is now looking forward to removing from the rules, but decided that probably didn't qualify as development because what they're removing are things that basically reference laws that have been off the books, some of which go back to 1941 was the last time they were on the books, and a bunch of other things we really don't look at these days. So it's a development, but not really one that's going to have any practical impact on your practice. So rather, let's talk about those things that will have a little bit more practical impact on your practice. And we're going to start with a case. This case is Trans Support Inc. versus Commissioner. This came from the First Circuit Court of Appeals as an appeal from a tax court decision. It's case number 17-1265. It came down on Valentine's Day, though I don't think the taxpayer was too happy at the end of this case. And we're going to talk about a business here that had actually been through two separate IRS audits regarding its method of accounting for cost of goods sold. The taxpayer is a wholesaler of engine and engine parts that are used in military vehicles. And the particular issue in this case revolved around the portion of the business where they bought parts in bulk from the U.S. government, then they resold those parts. They didn't take inventories at the end of the year of these parts. Rather, they would estimate what the cost of goods sold should have been by using a gross profit percentage, and that would allow them to sort of back into the beginning and ending inventory. They claimed they used a percentage that was consistent with industry standards, although didn't really have a whole lot of explanation. In fact, as the court observed, their cost of goods sold varied without explanation from year to year, and they had no records of how they exactly came up with these percentages in each of the years in question. Now, you might wonder, hearing that, why we even have an issue in this case. I mean, really, they were vaguely picking a percentage out of thin air, and then they were deducting that out of their tax return. And why in the world did we ever even go to court on this issue, as opposed to end up before the Court of Appeals? Well, part of the reason was, and this is something that we sometimes hear and I hear from various professionals and taxpayers, was they had been audited twice before on this issue. And, you know, the idea being, well, we've been audited before. And because we've been audited before on this issue, and in fact, on the two prior exams, the prior exams took place back in 1984 and again in 1992. And in neither of the two exams had the IRS actually adjusted cost of goods sold. In the first exam back in 84, the IRS had certainly raised questions about this, indicated that they didn't believe it was a method that should be used. But in the end, the agent decided not to make any changes here and didn't change things. In 1992, apparently it wasn't even brought up. So now we have the third exam for this taxpayer. And suddenly, this agent wasn't quite as easily swayed off this as the prior two. In the case, it's kind of interesting testimony. The owner of the business actually admits on the trial, on the stand, that while they only had just around $2 million of this inventory on the books, in fact, even less than that, $1,867,000, he admitted that the stuff they had on hand from these purchases was probably at least $100 million at cost. Well, that's kind of a big differential to explain as to why it's off that much. But they said, no. See, we have a lot of obsolescence. But the problem was they had no evidence of that obsolescence. The court found that, in fact, despite the fact that we had gone through two exams, neither of the exams had the IRS actually questioned this, you know, actually come down and said, nope, you can't do this. Despite having those two exams, in essence, sorry, guys, this doesn't work. The IRS pushed for an adjustment this time, and the appellate panel agreed the tax court had not erred in finding for the IRS. There's little doubt the taxpayer believed that there was no problem doing it this way because they had survived two prior exams. But let's be clear about something here. The fact that you have a position that survives an exam doesn't prove anything. It just proves that you got through the exam and the agent you had decided not to write this up. And their reasons for not writing it up could be good, bad, indifferent, but certainly there's not been any real test of this yet to let us feel comfortable that we now know that this position is or is not acceptable. You would think, when I describe this, that most of us should have recognized immediately that this sort of inventory system, and I guess that's really being kind to it, was not going to stand up if challenged. It was clearly not what was allowable under the law. It's not what should have been allowed. But you had those two exams before, and the client's going to focus on those two exams. Here's the problem. The client may have focused on those two exams, and while they did avoid the fraud penalty, they didn't avoid the gross understatement penalty, which is additional 20% on top of the tax due, along with interest. The exam in question actually covered, by the time it was done, this dragged on for a while because, of course, they were fighting, it had 9 years worth of adjustments by the time they were done. So this is 9 years worth of adjustments, the interest and penalties on the 9 years. And all of this because, essentially, they had not been using a method that was any way, shape, or form acceptable. I think a real problem that we run into here being advisors in this case is, yes, I know the client's going to want to keep doing it the way they always have. And yes, they're going to point out that, see, you know, let's be practical here. The IRS doesn't challenge this. But the reality is this client is open to penalties. And frankly, so is the person that signed the return if they were aware of how these inventory numbers were being derived, or they should have been aware of that. And the real problem you're going to have is, and I think we need to be very honest about this if we think about how clients think, is most likely the client's now going to decide that, well, you should have told me that this was wrong and that I was going to facing all these big penalties. And now because I have all these problems and all these issues, I think maybe you should pay for this. If you don't think a client will do that to you, just ask around for anybody that's ever done any work in the litigation realm for CPAs who have been subject to, let's say, claims of malpractice or errors, all those issues on the tax matters. Yeah, clients are going to quickly blame you. And that's going to be the problem that often comes up when you go along with something that you know is wrong, but hey, it survived an exam. Well, the Treasury Department had a lot of people sitting over at the American Bar Association's tax section meeting in San Diego. You know, February in San Diego is nicer than probably DC in February. And it's certainly nicer than being in certain other parts of the country in February. So they were down in San Diego last week, and a number of IRS, or I should say Treasury officials, were speaking in front of the convention. One of the initial things, and this was covered by tax analysts in a series of stories, and also it was picked up, some of you may have seen it in Bloomberg's news stories, there were a few questions that came up. First, there was a question regarding when are we going to get guidance? And Brian Rimke, attorney advisor of the Treasury Office of Tax Legislative Counsel, indicated that those items we talked about last week that were published in the 2017-2018 Priority Guidance Second Quarter Update, those items are ones that they believe they can get done by June 30th. Now, we should point out that Catherine Hughes, an attorney advisor, again, from the Treasury Office of Tax Legislative Counsel, in another session made the statement that, well, that's a hoped-for date, and hoped-for doesn't necessarily mean they'll actually make the date. But Mr. Rimke, in his session, emphasized that just because something's not on that second quarter list, it does not mean the IRS is not going to issue such guidance in a reasonable time frame. These are just the ones they were willing to commit to, I guess if we talk in terms of Ms. Hughes' theory, they're willing to commit to that maybe we'll get by June 30th. We think we can get them by then, and you know, and if we don't, well, we meant well. So go back to that list. Those are the first issues. In a separate session, we had a discussion, in this case, led by Dana Trier, the Treasury Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy. And what he ended up discussing was a lot of concern has developed around whether the IRS is going to expand reasonable compensation for Section 199 Cap A beyond S corporations. If you actually look at Internal Revenue Code Section 199 Cap A C4, that talks about reasonable compensation, which we're told is not qualified business income. As written, it says, qualified business income shall not include reasonable compensation paid to the taxpayer by any qualified trade or business of the taxpayer for services rendered with respect to the trade or business. Now, you notice nowhere in that sentence did I say S corporations. The Senate committee report that described this section when it was added did talk specifically about QBI does not include any amounts that are reasonable compensation paid to the S corporation shareholder. But they didn't take that S corporation language and incorporate it into the actual law. That led some people to worry that the IRS is going to expand this and start looking to take a portion out of, let's say, the flow-through income from a partnership. And we're not just talking about the guaranteed payment parts that don't count. We're talking about just the regular flow-through and say, hey, you know what? I think 60% of that is actually compensation for the partner services, and that won't get the 20%. In this case, the Treasury Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy, Dana Trier, said he's not really considering rewriting the entire area of reasonable comp. His interpretation, which he talked about with the staff that wrote the bill, is that this was meant to cover S corporations and S corporations only. But he did issue a warning. He said, look, he has to work. The law is the law. The law as written would allow the IRS to expand this because you read the law as written, there's nothing that stops it from going beyond S corps. But he said, I have no intention of doing so. The people I'm working with have no intention of doing so. And unless we get some order from on high that we are supposed to actually include that. And frankly, about the only people that it would appear to me could give that order from on high that would change this would be Treasury Secretary Mnuchin or the president. If neither one of those calls in and says, yeah, you need to do this, it looks like we're probably not going to get this reasonable comp expanded beyond 199 Cap A. I should point out, Bloomberg had an article this week that also, in addition, was dealing with this issue. And they went back to a comment from Mr. Rimke. And Mr. Rimke, when asked about this in a separate session, had simply stated that, you know, Treasury was considering whether or not, you know, this reasonable comp should cover something besides S-corps. And, you know, it was kind of a non-committal statement. But the article got headlined that Treasury may expand 199 Cap A reasonable comp beyond S-corps. I happen to think that's probably not the case. Basically, we have the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy. Deputy Assistant Secretary should be counsel, you know, basically a counsel advisor. And if he's not writing the reg, and he's the group that's in charge of writing the reg, if they're not writing that reg, it's probably not happening. So I would be reasonably confident that's not going to expand. A final session, and there were other things that happened at that conference. And if you have access to tax notes today, I strongly suggest you go back and take a look at the February 12th articles that are all about this ABA session, because a lot of things happened there. We had a final thing where they talked about the area of trust and estate income tax issues. And in this particular case, we ended up again with Catherine Hughes, again, attorney advisor from the Treasury Office of Tax Legislative Counsel, indicated there that the IRS expects to issue guidance on deductible items, including fiduciary fees and trustee fees, here in the near future. Now, a little concerned about her statement because the way I read the law, there's to me no question that executors' fees and trustees' fees are deductible. I think the concern is, and this is what tax analysts noted, that some people are reading Section 67G added by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which says, you know, basically no miscellaneous itemized deductions shall be allowed for any taxable year beginning after December 1st, 2017. And then they go back and they take a look at the definition of miscellaneous itemized deductions under Section 67B, and you'll find that trustees' fees aren't listed under the things that are not. 67B says miscellaneous itemized deductions are all those itemized deductions other than, and it's got a list. And I think what's happening is there's speculation coming out, people just reading that section. But I strongly suggest before you jump to too many conclusions, remember 6MB said it's itemized deductions that are not these things. The question becomes, well, what's an itemized deduction? That actually is defined in Section 62. Section 62 tells us an itemized deduction is a deduction not allowed in computing AGI. Here's the catch. 67E makes clear these deductions that are incurred because the assets are in trust are allowed in computing the trust AGI. I think while there may be a theory where the IRS could claim, well, you test that like an individual, I don't think that theory would hold water, and I don't expect we're going to see much anything risking our deduction on executor fees and trustees fees. Okay, if I'm wrong, you can write in and tell me, but I think we're safe there. Now, another issue came up. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin testified before the Senate Finance Committee. He actually did over 2 days this week. But on the 14th, Valentine's Day, he specifically was talking about carried interest planning, a particular issue that had gotten coverage. Bloomberg had indicated, and a lot of us had taken a look at this, Section 1061 provides a special rule that if you have a carried interest, and carried interests are effectively an investment partnerships where you get an interest that, you know, not it's a profits interest only. It's not a guaranteed payment. Rather, you simply get some percentage of the income of this partnership. And the reason you want to do that is this partnership is an investment partnership. It's generating a lot of capital gains, and you're going to be able to get taxed that at a maximum rate of 20%, 23.8, let's say, actually, in this case. So you get that max rate. It's like that. That's a lot nicer than paying 37% even today. So that was the structure. The law added a new Section 1061 that said, well, if you get that sort of interest, we have to recalculate long-term capital gains flowing from the partnership using a three-year rather than one-year holding period. But interestingly enough, Section C4, 1061 C4 says that this rule does not apply to any interest held by a corporation. Now, that's the only reference it made. It didn't say held by a C corporation. Now, it's pretty clear that's probably what Congress meant. It didn't apply to C corps. And frankly, you have to wonder why they worried about that, because a C corp doesn't get a special capital gain rate anyway. But there are some differences in capital gains. And yeah, it's like, but whether they're long term or not, there's not much difference. Nevertheless, they added that. Now, it turns out that a lot of, let's say, there's been discussion in Bloomberg of planning around this by having the interest be held not by the individual, but having this person who's going to do manage the hedge fund, have that person transfer their interest to an S corporation. The S corporation then holds the interest coming through to it. That S corporation would therefore not be subject to this rule. That would mean the capital gains would become one-year based capital gains. And then since an S corp doesn't pay tax, it would then flow that out to the to its shareholder as one-year gains, totally basically taking this provision out of the law. The Treasury Secretary was aware of this issue, and he indicated the IRS is going to come out with guidance to bar doing this in the next 2 weeks. And that's all well and good, but here's the problem. You have to worry the way the law is written whether Treasury, the IRS, has this authority. Now, arguing against it, and you've seen publications of people arguing against it, they said, look, the statute doesn't say S corporation or only C corporations. It says corporations. An S corporation is a corporation. Therefore, sorry, IRS, you can't change this. However, I see a way the service may be able to make this stick, because it does talk about the individual holding the interest directly or indirectly. And my guess is going to be they're going to try to argue that by putting it in the S corp, that's the equivalent of holding the interest indirectly, so that when it flows out of the S corp back to the individual, that's a transfer of the indirect interest, and that would require the three-year holding period. Again, we don't know until we see the guidance issued, and almost certainly you can expect a court challenge on this. We're talking about, you know, hedge funds with big money and managers who are able to pay to litigate this stuff. So don't be surprised if this one ends up in court, or at the very least, the, you know, Congress in essence goes back and tries to change this law to clarify what they meant. And I'm sure Treasury is hoping that they don't have to just try to rely upon their administrative change, that Congress will come back and actually make a direct change and say, yeah, what we meant was C-Corps. We have another case. We talked about this case, CRI Leslie LLC versus Commissioner. We talked about this case about 18 months ago. What happened in this case was the result was now appealed to the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has now issued its opinion, case number 16-17424. That came out on February the 15th. And what happened in this case was we had a $9.7 million deposit given to the owner of a hotel, which was a deposit given to them because it was a buyer who wanted to basically acquire the hotel. Under the terms of the agreement, that $9.7 million deposit was subject to forfeiture if the sale did not go through. The sale did not go through. So CRI Leslie LLC was the taxpayer that owned the hotel, held on to the $9.7 million deposit. Well, that's good. You know, you made $9.7 million. Okay, that's fine. That's not a bad amount of change to pocket. But the question becomes, what type of gain is it? The taxpayer, if you remember this case, we talked about it 18 months ago, took a look at Section 1234 Cap A. 1234 Cap A is a section we don't hit very often, but it does tell us that if gain or loss attributable to the cancellation, lapse, expiration, or other termination of a right is treated as a gain or loss from sale of a capital asset, if the asset as a whole, if disposed of by the taxpayer, would lead to a capital gain or loss if it was sold. Here's our problem. The property is a hotel being held by the taxpayer. The hotel is not a capital asset. It is rather under 1221A2 specifically excluded from the definition of capital assets. Now, it is clear that under 1231, if the asset is sold and 1231 gains exceed 1231 losses, then we will treat the gain as if it was a gain from a sale of a capital asset. But the tax court had held that 1234 Cap A requires it to be a capital asset. 1221 defines capital assets, says specifically an asset used in a trade or business of the taxpayer is not a capital asset. That by definition, 1234A could not apply. The taxpayer said, well, wait. That's crazy. You know, why should it be different depending upon whether I own that building, use it in a business, or whether I just held the asset for investment? You know, Congress clearly with 1231 says I'm going to get capital gain treatment if I sold that hotel. Had the sale closed, we would have effectively gotten 12. We'd have gotten 12 through 1231, gotten capital gain treatment. Why can't I get capital gain treatment for the deposit when the sale falls through? This is an odd result you can't explain in any reasonable manner. The 11th Circuit said, well, you know, here's our problem, guys. The plain language of the statute says it's not a capital asset. And 1234 Cap A requires it to be a capital asset. So the problem is the plain language says it doesn't count. Now you're saying, wait, this is absurd, right? This is a totally absurd result. The court said, well, it certainly is an odd result that you don't get capital gain treatment. And it's kind of difficult to explain. But the court said it is what's required by the plain language of the statute. And the court noted that we're not going to, even the only time we would go away from the plain language of a statute is if the result is clearly absurd. The court said this is an odd result, but this is not an absurd one. And the court said, here's the catch. It said, this isn't even close. We're not in the ballpark here. They said, look, you got $9.7 million worth of income. Your main complaint is being taxed at a higher rate. Not that, let's say, you had got $9.7 million and the result of the tax law would be to impose a tax of $22 million on you. No, you're just getting taxed at a higher rate. It's an odd result. Some things are taxed at capital gain rates, some things aren't. The fact that this is not taxed at capital gain rates, but is taxed as ordinary income, it's an odd result, but it's nowhere near close enough for us to overturn the actual law as written. If Congress does not like this result, it's up to Congress to change the law. Finally, Secretary Mnuchin came back a second day this week to talk to Treasury, to talk to Senate Finance Committee. And on February 15th, he let it be known, you know, we got a release date for when the IRS is going to issue a new W-4 calculator. The IRS apparently is close to finalizing the development of an online W-4 calculator. In fact, we would assume with what the Treasury Secretary told us this week that the development should probably be done. They should be in testing of this thing just to make sure they don't get any weird, absurd results. There's nothing odd happening that we can actually, you know, do all that, you know, quality control testing you're going to do before you take it live and have it beat on by a huge number of people. This new W-4 calculator will take into account the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act changes to the law and the changes to the withholding tables. So it'll allow you to kind of work up what your W-4, what your calculator comes up with, what you should put down for your withholding allowances. Secretary Mnuchin did not give an exact date for when this is going to go live, but the secretary did indicate that it would be sometime in this week we would see that W-4 calculator go live. For those of us who are in the business here of handling tax work, we all know the W-4 calculator is probably going to be fine for somebody who has one, who has, let's say, has a W-2, or it's a married couple, they each have W-2s. They, you know, may have a couple of kids and they've got a home mortgage interest. That's probably going to be useful to do the calculator. Obviously, as we also know, none of these calculators can really handle it if you have a complex situation. So maybe we should take some time out to think that you should consider for your clients, should you be telling them, look, we're not doing it for free, but given the major changes that are happening in the tax law and what's going on this year, you know, you probably should consider having us do a full calculation based on what we think your income will be to try to estimate where your tax will be next year and then work up an appropriate withholding number and back into your exemptions by doing that and have you give that in to take care of your payroll for the rest of the year. That's probably the best way to handle it. Those of you who have things like BNA's income tax planner, you're probably aware that has that sort of work. So the system built into it to back into a W-4. But it's something you should consider this year especially. We are looking at a rather major set of changes of how the law deals with things between the 2017 pre-Tax Cuts and Jobs Act law and the 2018 law with Tax Cuts and Jobs Act fully in place. Running those numbers, this is very different. The last time we faced this big a difference from one year to the next was back after the 86 Tax Act. We were looking at going from 86 to 87. 86 was under the old law. 87 would be under the new law. And I was in practice back then. And yes, that year we did a lot of this sort of calculations of trying to figure out, you know, what's exactly going to happen to this taxpayer under this law, and how does that impact how much they should be withholding and how much they should have working for estimated taxes. So just a thought as you get into tax season, you start seeing clients, you may want to put in their mind that it wouldn't be a bad idea if they don't want to take the risk of being grossly overpaid or grossly underpaid to maybe, you know, engage you to actually do a formal calculation to help them set their withholdings to the proper number for the coming year. Well, it's tax time. February 15th has gone by, so the consolidated 1099 due dates has passed. And if you're like my firm, that means that the flood is about to start, right? Everybody's going to get it. As we were talking about this past week, you know, it was out on the 14th. That was a Thursday. The 15th is a Friday. Okay, Monday's a holiday. So, but by Tuesday of, you know, the week you're listening to this, we probably should be seeing a bunch of people now suddenly having everything and bringing it in, calling for appointments, doing all that fun stuff. So while you try to maintain your sanity, you know, remember, lots of things have happened. There's going to be lots of developments while you've got your head down doing tax work during this season. So be sure to watch for courses coming from your state societies. I'm working right now on courses dealing with things like the qualified business income deduction, dealing with things like the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and how we're going to explain the darn thing and all the other neat things that are coming off of this law, looking at updating courses too. there's a lot to get up to speed on this law before the end of, before you get ready to do your planning for next year. So yeah, put your head down, get these returns done, but then consider to watch for the courses your state society is going to be offering you to let you get up to speed on actually applying the new rules to all the various tax issues. And oh, by the way, keeping up on all the guidance that's going to be trickling out over the next year. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for this week of February 19th, 2018. We'll have our updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com as they develop during the week. This past week, not really much happened. And my guess is we're going to keep seeing not much happen just because the IRS is right now trying to get all the reg projects up to speed. My guess is once they start issuing regs on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, we're going to have developments coming at a super fast pace. But right now, we've been calm. If you have any questions or comments about any of these items we talked about this week or anything else, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I am on Twitter. You can find me there. My handle there is @edzollers. So you can follow me. I'll post there as we do new material and new items during the week. If you want to, I also post some information on the Reddit group, /r/taxpros. So if you want to go over to Reddit, and take a look there. Reddit, as we said, it is kind of the wild, wild west of discussion groups. We're aware of that. But the discussion group on Tax Pros is very, you know, very professional, very calm, not overwhelming. So if you have some time, you can take a look over there. And certainly you want to post a question there. It'll allow both I can take a look at it and the other members of the group can take a look at it. So if you haven't come over there, you might try. Otherwise, hopefully you have a good week this week. All those consolidated 1099 miscellaneouses will start showing up here. And so you'll be able to really get into tax season. Hey, let's see now. It's less than 2 months before it's over. Doesn't make you feel better. We're just beginning and we've only got less than 2 months and it's April 15th. Oh, well, all that fun. So in any event, I hope to see you next week. We'll talk to you more about the current federal tax developments taking place.